Hi, this is Paula Morrell. Welcome to Tales from the South.
Kiss those lips and say I love you. But chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you. But chances are you won't give me a chance to be with you.
How's everybody doing tonight? So about tonight's music by the Salty Dogs. Y'all like the Salty Dogs? The Salty Dogs are an acclaimed four-piece band from Little Rock that has released three full-length studio albums, including the band's current album, Brand New Reason. They have CDs for sale after the show, and more can be found at thesaltydogs.net. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Among other things, Mark has performed with the late Jelly Roll Kings members Frank Frost and Sam Carr. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock artist Stanley Kypern. And our featured piece is this piece right over here, which is a pyrography piece. And it's entitled Romance Barn, and it is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Stanley at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are we all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight's stories are all about the delicate art of communication. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Candace Parker struggles to find the right words. And we'll end the night with Bob Longo as language barriers create chaos. But let's start the night with Catherine Schultz and a series of calls over many years in Phone Calls.
The story of my life with Scott begins with a phone call. In fact, much of my life with Scott was marked by phone calls. The first was from David. He called to say he had scheduled a vasectomy. I said, go ahead. I was afraid of being pregnant. I had nearly died of an abortion 2 years before Roe v. Wade. The doctor agreed to see me and mother after hours. I was single, 22 years old. While I was on the table, he did something that hurt really bad. Soon, I was hemorrhaging. At the hospital, another doctor asked, what butcher got a hold of her? Back home, I got a phone call from David asking how I was. We had met in college and had become good friends. Our friendship waned when I married John and he married Doris. Neither marriage worked. After 4 years, we began an affair. Soon we knew we were going to end our marriages, and that's when David called about the vasectomy. In my fear, I equated being pregnant with the botched abortion, so I said, go ahead. By fall, we had gotten divorced, married each other, and were living in Rogers. He taught, I worked for newspapers. We moved away for graduate school, then came back to Northwest Arkansas, and a decade passed without our thinking about children. Then I met Jean, the local adoption specialist for the Department of Human Services. All I had to do was mention that David and I thought perhaps someday we would adopt, and Jean was on the case. In a few months, there was a phone call. Are you ready to be a mother? Jean asked. We met little Joey on my 39th birthday. He was 12 but looked 9. Within the month, he was living with us and adoption was underway. We had learned a lot about Joey. His mother left when he was 2 weeks old. His father abused him physically, emotionally, and sexually. He was often hungry. He repeated the first grade and was chronically absent in the fourth. We learned in our training about how early neglect can be difficult, if not impossible, to overcome. But like so many adoptive parents, we refused to believe that a child would react poorly to our kind of parenting. After all, we were so cool. We were advised to change his first name if he was willing, and he was. He chose Scott. Within a month, the phone calls began. The first was from Scott. He was a latchkey kid for about an hour each afternoon, and in that time, he managed to break the glass patio door. He explained how it happened. He said a truck drove by and tossed up a big rock, which hit the door and broke the glass. What a warped sense of physics my child had. Said rock would have had to jump a 6-foot fence, make a 90-degree turn, and somehow manage to suck the door, because the safety glass was dented from the inside out. Phone calls over the next few years were more serious. He threw away the answer sheets for his class's standardized tests. He made obscene phone calls to a teacher. He stole money from someone's gym bag. And finally, he broke into the nice old lady's house across the street and stole a diamond ring wrapped for Christmas giving. That was it. We sent him to a residential program where he stayed 14 months. He ran away from lockdown several times, once nearly causing a riot when responding police overreacted to the rebellious youth left behind. He ran away from home, too. The first time, he stayed away 5 hours. I cried and cried and thought it might be the end of the adoption. The second time, I went to the lake and left a note on the door. I adjusted to this detached kind of motherhood, a balance one has to maintain with a child so damaged. He was 17 when he got out of residential care. He was better, but he was homesick. He loved us, but he was an alien in our world. It was time to make a phone call to the good sister of the East, Eastern Arkansas, the one who had reported their father's abuse. We let Scott visit his family during spring break. The reunion was more than he could take, and a month after returning to our home, he went back to his home. I kept up with him through the sister. He was not doing well, drunk, not working, in trouble. A year after he left, I got a phone call. "Mom, I want to come home." And so he did. We said he would have to go back to school or work, and he did neither. So 2 weeks later, David met him at the door with his bags packed and took his key. Scott knew he was welcome to visit, and he did. We grew pretty close then, but the trouble was never far away. One night, I got a phone call from one of his friends. "Scott got shot!" The detachment set in. Once I found out it wasn't serious, I couldn't stop musing over the rhyme, "Scott got shot." The next morning, the newspaper brief said Scott had reported a drive-by shooting. Damn that physics again. Seems the shot entered his thigh at an angle that could have been accomplished only by what really happened. He had shoved a loaded pistol into his waistband and it went off. Scott moved back to Eastern Arkansas soon after that. We would hear from him occasionally in a letter written by yet another girlfriend asking for money. He was in and out of relationships, in and out of jail. In 1999, I got a phone call from him. "Mom, you're a grandma." I saw baby Heather when she was 6 weeks old. The next time I saw her, she was 11. Scott was not the kind of father Heather deserved. His drug and alcohol use, his jail stints, all the trouble that his life embraced was not the stuff of good daddying, so he was not allowed much time with her. In 2010, I got a phone call from Scott. He had kicked the booze and the dope, and he had a new girlfriend, a good woman, he said. Heather was spending much more time with him. We arranged for her to visit for her 12th birthday, and he and the rest of the clan came to Fayetteville to retrieve her. It was the last time I saw Scott alive. He had COPD and was still smoking. He was on disability, and he stayed home watching sports. He would call, and we would talk, mostly about Heather, and he told me how much it meant to him that David and I took him in. Less than a year later, I got a phone call from Heather's mother. Scott was dead. He had refused to go to the hospital despite trouble breathing, and he had collapsed at home. He was taken to the hospital and put on life support so the family could say goodbye. He had stated his preferences quite clearly. He did not want to donate any part of his body, and he did not want to be cremated. I was waiting to hear about the funeral arrangements. I got a phone call from his girlfriend. Seems Scott had married one of those women along the way and never divorced her, and now she had shown up to claim the body. She, by God, was gonna donate his organs and cremate the rest, and no one in the family was gonna get any ashes either. I made the next phone call to the hospital to see whether, as his adoptive mother, I had the right to overrule her. I did not. So I grieved through the drama that followed that week, and David and I left for a trip to San Francisco. The next morning, I got a phone call at the hotel. "We got the body back," said the girlfriend. "Seems that Scott had hepatitis C. No one wanted any of his body parts, and thus the wife lost interest. So the body was at the funeral home, and could I call and arrange to pay for part of the services?" I called the funeral home. The proprietors were not willing to give the girlfriend credit, so she had to raise all the money up front. They had received the body and had embalmed it. I asked what now seems to be an insensitive question, but my head was spinning. "Why would you embalm the body before you know whether she's able to raise the money?" The answer over the phone was pretty straightforward. "Well, he died 6 days ago." And with that, it was over, and I hung up the phone.
Catherine Schultz teaches journalism at the University of Arkansas, Fayetteville. She grew up in Marianna, Arkansas, and worked in newspapers most of her career. Her stories have been on NPR's Morning Edition and the BBC's America. Next, when Candace Parker's words fail, she takes matters into her own hands in The Geographical Importance of the One.
It was a time in my relationship with Carson where I was evaluating how I was really feeling. A discussion comparable to a personal survey where one must circle strongly agree or simply no. 3 weeks prior to Carson's arrival in Little Rock for our 1 year anniversary, I realized that he probably wasn't the one and that survey talk needed to happen. Keep in mind that this was my first real relationship and nobody had advised me that the art of breaking up was directly comparable to a peanut allergy. My throat would swell, and when I attempted to speak, I would start sweating. Regardless, I made the phone call that for Carson was beyond unexpected. I had what we would call an awkward high school phase, where going out with boys was a foreign activity, much like racquetball or perhaps jousting. I'm not sure at what point I officially decided to get myself out there and experience the world of free dinners and forced conversation, but it coincided with my beginning college a couple of years ago and peaked with the blossoming of my first real relationship, one that would ultimately end me second-guessing anything I have learned from Jennifer Lopez movies and 17 Magazine, which suggested that my future husband would never smell bad, we would never tire of each other, and we would ride off into sunset, throwing our heads back in laughter at the hilarious shenanigans we had found ourselves in whilst living out this romantic comedic plot. Most importantly, I finally understood that if you think it's not where you're from, it's where you're at, then as we say down here in the South, bless your heart. I'll paint my picture quickly. Carson and I met through mutual friends. He was trendy, listened to NPR, and sported a nose ring that seemed perfectly artsy and just daring enough to piss off my dad. He didn't have a job. But when you're young and in love, you don't see the red flags Oprah and your mom warned you about when you were little. The curveball I'm pitching you here is that not only was he my first real boyfriend, he also lives in California. I live in Arkansas. I don't know if you've been to California, but it's a land that thrives on mixed greens and is confused by cheese dip and sweet tea. And if Little Rock were the Old West, Carson would have walked into a saloon and been shot by someone who clearly recognized him as an outsider and purveyor of skinny jeans. Clearly, I was new to the foundations of a stable relationship. We dated for a year, and though the back and forth travel between Little Rock and California was an expensive hobby, I justified it like rich women justify a third glass of wine or pedicures. This luxury was actually a necessity. 1 year later, after our first date, I made the breakup call. I don't know if you've ever been sobbed to before. If you haven't, perhaps you've been in the same room as someone dry heaving and then projectile vomiting onto a hardwood floor. Whatever you can relate to, the conversation went kind of like that. I hung up the phone, experiencing emotions that are probably felt by most hit-and-run drivers. A day passed, and as I walked to my front door, I saw boxes on top of boxes of gifts stacked next to my welcome mat. At first glance, I simply assumed that had been another long night of insomnia for my mother that usually began with Ambien and ended with several winning auctions on eBay. But if only I could have been so lucky. Since I was new to the game, I didn't know it was okay to reject flowers. And thus, I found myself picking him up at the Little Rock Airport 3 weeks later. The week of his visit felt a lot like a plot for a Nicolas Cage movie, with me scheming to strategically end the relationship without getting snot on me. This is an opportune time in my story to mention that during this relationship, I was and still am living with my parents. Personally, I like to call this a transitional period, but it is what it is. By the end of the week with Carson, my dad and I were high-fiving in the driveway in celebration of the end of this ongoing relationship. It was going to be the day of the clean break. I would give my speech during our drive to the airport, we would fist bump, and I would never ever see him again. It was a foolproof plan. It did not go that way. The conversation was as comfortable as smelling burnt hair, and the hug at the airport was less than enjoyable. Regardless, I was free. I drove away from the airport in victory. I called my friends. I called the lady who cuts my hair, and I'm pretty sure a little bird flew on my shoulder as a rainbow formed behind me in the sky. I was the epitome of strong and successful. And then I got a phone call. Carson had canceled his flight. He did not know when to reschedule and desired to win me back. This is when I started to cry. It's where my rainbow faded and the bird on my shoulder pooped. So, of course, I did what any inexperienced dating woman does. I called my roommate. I mean, my mom. Her only encouragement was to leave his sorry grown self there. To me, that seemed like cruel and unusual punishment, considering the heartache I had just placed on this single human being. Somehow, I find myself back at the airport picking up what is now my ex-boyfriend who has no intention of rescheduling his flight. The car back to my house was as comfortable as wearing underwear belonging to someone skinnier than you. The night he spent on my couch was even worse. My parents and I were paralyzed with awkwardness, locked in our room, sending text messages and reviewing the scenario of what we would do if he attempted to kill us. I remember at one point in the middle of the night, my mom gently opening my door to ask if she could show me what she had learned at Krav Maga the week before, then warning me to lock my door. Carson didn't kill anyone. In fact, to make his story more sad and appealing, he walked 2 miles to Kroger at some point between 10 p.m. and early the next morning to purchase gifts and snacks that would make me the most popular girl in the office the next day. The morning came. I knew what I had to do. I got up, put on my big girl panties, and told him to get in the car. I drove him to the airport, dropped him off at the sidewalk, and said, "I'm sorry, figure it out. Peace out, player." No eye contact, no fist bump. He walked away, shoulders sagging. I put it in drive and squealed the tires. And I'm sitting here telling you this story today, hoping someone hears me and learns from my mistake. If he doesn't say y'all and can't take a hint, there's a good chance he's probably not the one.
Candace Parker is a 19-year-old student at the University of Arkansas Little Rock. When she's not in school, Candace can be found working on various graphic design projects or trying her best to be awesome every single day. In our final story of the night, Bob Longo attempts to pull a fast one, but all communications fail in Rescued.
So it was Valentine's Day, and my wife and I were in Paris. She had come with me on a multiple-country business trip to upgrade various computer systems. Being this special day, I had booked a dinner cruise for that night down the Seine River. Talk about romantic. Talk about unforgettable. Talk about scoring points. On this particular trip, I was meeting my colleague Mark from the London office to assist me with the work. That afternoon, Mark and I went to the office in the very densely populated business and residential opera district in downtown Paris. We started the computer upgrade, but as typical, we ran into an issue that was going to take quite a while to resolve. To top it off, my boss back in the US said, "This must be fixed before the office starts up tomorrow, so I guess you're not going on your little dinner cruise tonight." My boss delighted in our misery. As you can imagine, I knew this would not go over well with my wife, who was back at the hotel room getting dressed for our big night. Being a good husband and a hopeless romantic, I came up with a brilliant idea. I told Mark to meet me back at the office at midnight and we would fix the computer issue in the early morning hours and no one would be the wiser. Being a good old lad from London, Mark decided to go to the pub. My wife and I went on the cruise. It was a beautiful cruise. Up and down the Seine with the monuments all lit up, the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre, the Notre Dame. We even had a singer break out into New York, New York when we passed the little Statue of Liberty. After the cruise, I dropped my wife at the hotel and went to the office. It was a little before midnight and I took the elevator, or lift as they say, to the third floor office to begin my work. I was working very quickly and with earnest, knowing I was under a time crunch so my boss would not find out I had gone on the cruise. A little after midnight, I heard Mark calling from the elevator shaft. I ran to the elevator shaft and could hear him yelling, "Bob! You're not going to believe this, but the lift is not working." Was he slurring just a little bit? I told him to search for the stairs and that I really needed to get back to work. The next message from the elevator shaft was, "Bob, you're not going to believe this, but there's a woman who lives on the first floor and it seems I've woke her up. Bob, she is Portuguese and cannot understand a word I am saying. So I drew her a picture. Don't worry, Bob. I think she now understands, has gone back into her apartment and hopefully to help us." I reminded Mark I was very busy and to please handle it. If he could not make it up, then just forget it and go back to the pub. I'm busy. Next message. "Bob, you're not gonna believe this, but the police have arrived and they're asking me questions in French I don't quite understand." I said, "Mark, please explain everything is okay and that I'm fine and to please leave me alone. Everything is fine." "Okay, Bob, I've shown them the picture from the Portuguese lady and they're now discussing it." "Okay, Mark." Sheer silence, working blissfully, about 10 minutes. "Bob, you're not gonna believe this, but the SWAT team is here." "Mark, please tell them I'm okay, please." "You're not gonna believe this, but it seems the extent to their troubleshooting was to jiggle the handle." "Mark, please." "Okay, Bob, they've gone outside and they're having a meeting on the front steps, and now the Portuguese lady is serving them tea." Minutes pass. "Bob, you're not gonna believe this, but the fire brigade is here." Sure enough, I went to the window, opened it, stuck my head out to see the fire department, the police, the red and blue flashing lights, and the Portuguese lady serving everyone tea. And of course, there was Mark right in the middle of the group, waving at me with a big smile. Mark was having tea also. I was speechless. I tried to get back to work, but I knew it was not going to turn out well. Minutes passed, and then it happened. I felt a rumble. I ran to the window and quickly saw the biggest hook and ladder truck I have ever seen. This truck was so big, they had to close the street so they could come right down the middle and park in front of the building. By now, of course, a rather large crowd had gathered. And you guessed it, in what seemed like an eternity, they slowly extended the ladder up to the third floor window that I was working in. A very nice fireman then slowly climbed up to meet me, and he was carrying a shiny steel helmet for me to wear while being rescued. With my mouth wide open, I turned off the lights, put on my jacket and my shiny helmet, and climbed out the window and down the ladder. My memory is fading, but I think I remember everyone clapping once I touched the ground. The police then escorted me and Mark to the back of a police van, and a very nice detective sat down to listen to our story. He nodded like he understood, and he studied our passports for a while. Then I got to see the picture Mark had drawn for the Portuguese lady and the other rescuers. It was a man in a box. The detective studied the picture and smiled. He then said in broken English with a very heavy French accent, "Could you please get me New York Knickerbocker's hat?" Yes, of course, yes, anything to end this nightmare. He wrote out his address, gave us our passports and the picture of a man in a box, and sent us on our way. Mark never stopped laughing. I got in the cab and went back to the hotel room. Mark and I met at the office at 6 a.m. when the building opened, and luckily we were able to repair the computer system before the office opened at 9 o'clock. We have since learned the lift shuts down after midnight, and that's why it didn't work for Mark. I left Paris for the London office that night and arrived very early the next day. As I entered the office on one of the upper floors, I walked into a room full of cubicles, and someone, without popping up to look around, asked, "Who goes there?" I said, "It's Bob from the United States office, and I'm here to do the computer upgrade." Not missing a beat, the person replied, "Did you come in through the window?" Seems my little story traveled fast.
Bob Longo and his best friend and wife, Amy, are transplanted Yankees who love living downtown in the Little Rock River Market neighborhood and consider themselves very fortunate to have many dear friends. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.